Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, September 25th, 2013. Ted Cruz almost filibuster is over.
It's hard to see the politicking with your eyes closed, but bet they listen, they got tracking on your iPhone. They control the way you work, the way you eat, the way you sleep, and all the money that you make ain't yours to keep. Cause they gon' tax that ass and you can bet upon it. When you sign a dotted line, you put your neck upon it. And yes, it's true, all the food and the drugs that enter into your system have been FDA approved, but all the chemicals and steroids that they use to make your chicken bigger is what gets you fucking sick of, dude. And they ain't curing shit, but they gon' charge you for every visit and every pill that they say has the cure in it. They let the 1% make the rules. The richest ones are gonna give the funds to put the friends in power too. So go and get a gun, but let them catch you with one, and you gon' do at least a lap around the sun.
Why are we suspicious of all the shit that they
do? Song is called Suspicious. And this is an American debut for music that comes from a new record label in Albany, New York called Rustic Justice. My friend David Rabin was here and turned me on to this the other night. This is Merc featuring Mike Laney and Knowledge. Proletarian variants, trouble just bubble through. And I am hardly a leader of the hip-hop nation, but I think they do some pretty cool stuff there. Check it out, Rustic Justice. You can find them on Facebook or other places online. Well, I don't know if Ronald Reagan channeled into the United States Senate earlier today, but right around noontime, Ted Cruz stopped talking and yielded the floor.
In spite of the tax increase, shut up.
Well, he did shut up, finally. And after 21-plus hours, where he did most of the talking, Ted Cruz, I think, had to accept reality. He was not persuading fellow Republican senators to join his dive off the fiscal cliff. And John McCain is particularly angry at Cruz and went gunning for him. He blasted him for suggesting that Republican lawmakers hadn't fought hard enough to stop Obamacare. After all, it got, zero Republican votes in the House and just a handful in the Senate. McCain said he campaigned all over America last year to repeal and replace Obamacare. But much to his dismay, he said the people spoke and they reelected the president who had campaigned on going ahead with the law. And McCain also vigorously objected to Cruz's comparison of those who wouldn't fight with him as appeasers, like Chamberlain before World War II. And so Ted Cruz, in pandering to the extreme, rabid, radical base of the Tea Party right, has really driven a wedge into the Republican Party. I hope it stays there. And I hope that they lose their ability to obstruct the limited, rather cautious agenda of the president and the Democrats. And I hope that this is the beginning of a decline that will see particularly the Tea Party right lose seats in 2014 and take whatever mo may exist out of the momentum for a Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, or Marco Rubio run for president. So I think that's all very good. And just before I sat down here behind the microphone, I was looking at Facebook, and Paul Anderson had posted a picture of Ted Cruz right next to a file photograph of Senator Joe McCarthy, the rabid anti-communist from the 1950s, with the question, separated at birth? And I encourage you to find a picture of each of them. Maybe somebody will post it on your Facebook page, but there are some interesting similarities. And one of the things that continues to bug me is the way the Republicans grossly misstate public sentiment about Obamacare. Today, Mitch McConnell was at it again. He said, Americans overwhelmingly oppose this law. Now, that is only a true statement if you factor in the people like me who don't support Obamacare because it's not single payer, because it enshrines, it embeds the for-profit insurance, HMO, and pharma industries in ways that I would never support. And when you take apart the polls and you break down those who say they are opposed to Obamacare, more than half of those opposed are like me, because it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't restrain costs. It doesn't cover every American. And Medicare for All would do just that. And the other little bomb on the tracks of this impending train wreck, that's the favorite metaphor, is that Treasury Secretary Jack Lew announced today that October 17th is the day we hit the debt ceiling and have to stop paying our bills. And so that puts even more pressure on the obstructionism of the Republican right, on the deep divide in John Boehner's House of Representatives. And it's going to be, you know, quite a struggle for the next few weeks. They have until Monday night at midnight to pass a budget or a continuing resolution to keep the government in operation, or it shuts down next Tuesday. We have gone that far to the brink. And some people think Ted Cruz is a genius, but the MacArthur Foundation announced their genius grants for this year, and he's not on the list. Of course, I'm not either. As I mentioned on Monday, the political theater this week is at two venues, in Washington on Capitol Hill, and in New York in Manhattan at the United Nations. And it's fascinating to see how things have played out. The new president of Iran, Rouhani, conducted himself quite well. He has denied the denial of the Holocaust, which was a big, at least a rhetorical problem spawned by his predecessor, Ahmadinejad. And aside from the fact that Israel and its delegation walked out while the president of Iran was speaking, he really set a tone for a whole new approach to these issues. And I think that's good. So remains to be seen. Rouhani is predicting that if talks begin shortly, and there are plans for John Kerry to meet with the Iranian foreign minister on Thursday, he thinks within 3 months, things could change dramatically. Now, Iran wants the sanctions lifted. That is their top goal. And I'm one of those people who has believed our intelligence community and the estimates that show that Iran is not developing a nuclear weapon. And if they allow greater inspections, more so-called transparency, we may be able to make some progress here. Regarding the Holocaust, Rouhani said, "I'm not a historian, but in general I can tell you that any crime that happens in history against humanity, including the crime the Nazis created towards the Jews as well as non-Jews, is reprehensible and condemnable. Whatever criminality they committed against the Jews, we condemn." But he went on to say in the CNN interview, "This does not mean that on the other hand you can say Nazis committed crimes against a group, now therefore they must usurp the land of another group and occupy it. This, too, is an act that should be condemned." So I think Rouhani is very well modulated in his presentation. We'll just have to see if it does gain traction over the next few weeks. President Obama really didn't change his stripes at the United Nations. Still taking a very hard line on Syria, still insisting that the threat of force is what produced the break here, and that if the UN can't agree to strike Syria, if it continues to defy the international community, that it is a failed organization. But this was the real annoying and insulting line in Obama's speech. And he used the word insult. He said, "It's an insult to human reason and to the legitimacy of this institution, the UN, to suggest that anyone other than the regime carried out this attack. Now, there still remains a significant lack of evidence about who is responsible for the August 21st use of the chemical weapon sarin in the Damascus suburb of Ghouta. And in our in-depth interview today with journalist Robert Perry, we go pretty deep in looking at the lack of evidence, at the way the Obama administration and Secretary of State Kerry in particular have hammered away with circumstantial evidence at best, just saying, we know, we know, we know, and therefore the rest of us are all supposed to be convinced. But Bob Perry has been around the block a few times. And as he expresses in this excerpt from our in-depth interview, which is available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, there's too much secrecy on all sides here. Russia, the United States, Syria. And it's clear that the leaders are not willing to share the so-called evidence with little people like you and me. Here's Bob Perry.
One has to be more skeptical, I think, when you're dealing with specific warnings from the UN inspectors that they are dubious about the conditions they're finding, whether they've been sort of staged in effect, mm-hmm. and whether they can be trusted. So this still brings to me the point that the United States and, frankly, the Russians, the Russians have a 100-page report which they say proves the rebels did it, but neither government has been willing to share that with the public. And this gets to a more troubling point, which is this addiction to secrecy mm-hmm. that we see on the part of many governments, where they don't want to share information with the public so things can be examined and independently inspected. They'd rather, they consider transparency, apparently, giving things to other insiders. President Obama, for instance, seems to think that transparency on these issues means sharing some stuff with Congress, and there are representatives, not making things public to the American people. And there's something very elitist and really anti-democratic about it. Plus, I think it's a way, when you don't have very strong evidence, you can count on most of the politicians either not to have the time to inspect things carefully or not to have the courage to. They have other agendas rather than the truth. So what you see here is this effort to sort of keep the American people out of any careful examination of the facts that could still lead us into a war. And what you saw when the president spoke before the UN, he said essentially no rational person can doubt this evidence, which to me is also concerning, because when you start saying something like that, we're not going to really show you our evidence, but anyone who doubts us is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way of sort of stampeding the process. And we've seen this again and again and again.
You can hear the full interview with Robert Perry. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And shortly after I spoke with Bob Perry, news broke in the Washington Post that the so-called rebels in Syria, 11 of the factious groups there, have formed a new Islamic-labeled group that has at least temporarily been dubbed the Islamist Alliance. And this is being led by the so-called Al-Qaeda-affiliated group Jabhat al-Nusra. They are the lead signatory of this new group, which includes, get this, the Tawhid Brigade, which is the biggest Free Syrian Army unit in the northern city of Aleppo. The largest rebel group in Damascus is Liwa al-Islam. Then there is Arar al-Sham, the most successful nationwide franchise of mostly Syrian Salafist fighters. And don't forget the Chechens, who were there on the payroll of Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, various mercenaries who were there on the payroll of the emirs of Kuwait and Qatar, and don't forget those U.S.-paid mercenaries, some of whom came over from Libya with guns that were being stored in Benghazi. There is also another group that is reportedly aligned with Al-Qaeda called the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. And so we have this dizzying array of groups that are all lumped together as the rebels. And when you hear people like Senator Carl Levin talk about arming the vetted moderates in Syria, then you have to ask Senator Levin, who the hell are you talking about? Which one of these groups with Islamic leanings do you consider to be a vetted moderate? And a spokesman for this new Islamist alliance says the scope for Western influence over the Syrian opposition has now been diminished considerably. And once again, I ask, if we are going to give arms to the so-called rebels in Syria, how do we know who we're giving them to, who they will be used against, and if they might ever be used against Americans or our interests? These are the questions that underscore the real dangers that are often blithely tossed off as talking points by America's leaders. I always like to identify the people who subscribe and support my podcast efforts, including today Joey Hundert, Michael Gill, and a couple of new subscribers, Diane Morris and Daryl Rotramel. Thank you all for your support. And if you have not yet become a subscriber, it is never too late. Just go to my website, peterbcollins.com, and follow the link that says sign up right under my picture, the mugshot on the upper left-hand corner of the homepage. You can take out a 24-hour pass for $1, a $5 a month subscription, cancel anytime, or the best deal, our $50 annual subscription. And if you're a new annual subscriber, you get a bag of that fabulous, I can smell it from here, Kona coffee, grown by Russ Archibald and his buddies on the Big Island of Hawaii. And I have a few copies left of Sibel Edmonds' Classified Woman book, if you act now. So log on to peterbcollins.com and start up that new subscription. I will be much obliged. The other way you can support us is by steering your web business to GoDaddy.com. Right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the rate starts at $1.99 a month. Can you beat that? I don't think so. And they'll give you your domain name free. So follow the link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com for another screaming deal from GoDaddy.com. Yesterday, we told you about the Pakistani lawyer who was scheduled to speak at an ad hoc hearing on Capitol Hill today, and he was bringing with him the survivors of a drone strike in Pakistan about a year ago. But the attorney, Shahzad Akbar, has not been granted a visa. The family members and the children, survivors of this attack in the village of Tapi in North Waziristan last year, their visas have been cleared. But the guy who is supposed to escort them, the attorney, has not been given a current visa. Akbar told the British newspaper The Guardian, "It's not like my name is scratched because there is some sort of confusion. My name is blocked." He said, "Before I started drone investigations, I never had an issue with U.S. visas. In fact, I had a U.S. diplomatic visa for 2 years. And this is the third time Akbar has experienced problems with U.S. authorities over a visa since he began investigating drone strikes." Think there might be a connection? Just maybe? And speaking of those drones, we are often led to believe that they work perfectly, that they, you know, operate by remote control, so no American lives are ever put at risk, and that this is just the new surgical sanitized way to slaughter your enemies. But the U.S. has had to move its drone fleet from the main airport in Djibouti at a place called Camp Lemonnier because of safety concerns, because our drones kept falling out of the sky, because there has been a string of crashes that left local people afraid that these robotic aircraft would fall out of the sky and kill them. So this month, they stopped flying drones from the U.S. installation in Djibouti and moved to a secret base somewhere inland. And these drones are used to monitor the activities of Al-Shabaab. the terrorist group that is considered responsible for the Nairobi shopping mall attack, which has killed more than 60 people, and may still not be completely over. So the problem has been that there's been this rash of accidents. At least 5 drones have crashed since January 2011, including one that plowed into the ground next to a neighborhood in Djibouti's capital. And as a result, even though we pay Djibouti $38 million a year to land our drones there, they've said, you know, you got to move. And so we have shifted to an interior location in the nation of Djibouti. And I'll just remind you, the other day we mentioned that there is a plan to insert more U.S. forces into Kenya. And I am aware of no debate or approval of that in any way, shape, or form by the United States Congress. We're getting more details on the shooting spree a week ago Monday at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. And there's plenty of coverage of this, so I want to focus on 2 angles. One is that the story keeps changing. Like so many of these events that are covered in real time by the corporate media in this country. And then within a week, the narrative has changed and there is no reference to all of the breathless reporting they gave us from on the scene or nearby at the time these events were unfolding. And one of the elements that has been scrubbed from the narrative, the recap of the events at the Washington Navy Yard, was the presence of members of the Capitol Police Emergency Squad. I reported on this the other day. There were at least 3 of these Capitol Police officers who had what they call long guns, so they had rifles or automatic weapons with them. They were among the first to respond. They were told by the Metropolitan Police to proceed because they had better weapons than the cops did. When they checked with their commander, they were told to leave the Navy Yard immediately. Now, this is curious. I don't know what happened there, and there may be no, you know, conspiracy or dark explanation. But we see this happen all too often, the Boston Marathon bombing. Story changed dramatically. We still don't understand why Todashev was killed in Florida. And so I just think it's worth noting this. The other thing I want to mention is that the man who has been fingered for this crime, and he died in the crossfire, Aaron Alexis, the 34-year-old, is described as mentally troubled. And they are feeding information to the media to support that notion. And Alexis left a note. There are inscriptions on his Remington shotgun and documents found on his phone and laptop. In one he wrote, "An ultra-low frequency attack is what I've been subject to for the last 3 months, and to be perfectly honest, that is what has driven me to this." Now, the letters for an extremely low frequency attack are ELF. Scratched into the shotgun was a scrawled message, "My ELF weapon." Now, as you know, I have no direct contact with this investigation. I had never heard of Aaron Alexis before. But what I'm ready to tell you is that this is not the first time that I have heard allegations of some sort of system of mind control based on ELF, extremely low frequencies. And whenever I mention this, whenever I talk to whistleblowers, you would not believe some of the emails I receive from individuals whose stories are consistent and, I have to say, fairly credible, that they have been subjects of these kinds of electronic mind control efforts. And I have no proof. So I want to just tell you that this is speculative information. It is anecdotal when it reaches me. But it's come from different regions of the country. One guy says he's a former FBI agent who's working on a book about his experiences. Another is a man from New England who has emailed me for several years now. And I don't read every one of his emails, but the ones I've read provide his narrative of being constantly hounded by a surveillance system that is electronic. Now, recently, I had a chance to meet with Russell Tice, NSA whistleblower. He served at the highest levels of the NSA and was deep, deep into its black programs. So I just asked him about this. And without any indication that he was misleading me or dissembling or falsely denying this in any way, he just said, "Peter, there is no program like that." And so I have no conclusion to offer you in this respect. But when I read this kind of article that is basically taking a guy who's dead and cannot speak for himself, and we hear notes that he left, and we see him characterized as just a crazy man, well, these are things that deserve to be investigated. And I, for one, am curious to know more. We've been keeping you up to date with the effort by a three-court federal judge panel. Let me say that again. A three-judge federal court panel. That's better. Which has been monitoring the overcrowding in California's prisons, the impact of that overcrowding on the health care and the deaths and illnesses of prisoners in our system. It's a long-running controversy, and Governor Jerry Brown has been thumbing his nose at the court and saying, "Give me back control of California's prisons." And I've repeatedly shared the stories with you that, to me, are the evidence why the state of California isn't competent to run its prisons. So the issue has come down to the federal courts telling the state it must release roughly another 9,000 prisoners before the end of this year to reduce the population level to 138% of the projected capacity. And Jerry Brown is still fighting. He lost a skirmish because the three-judge panel issued an order on Tuesday afternoon. And it gave the governor a one-month extension. He had asked for 3 years to reach the goal of reducing the population. So the new deadline is the end of January 2014, and there are about just under 10,000 prisoners who have to be dealt with. The governor has been prepared to burn through hundreds of millions of dollars in California's newly created reserve fund to rent prison beds at corporate prisons in California and some outside of the state. And the judges are saying, that's not a very good idea. That's a waste of money. And they are aligning with the president of the state Senate, Daryl Steinberg. I had the pleasure of introducing him at an event over this past weekend where he talked about his negotiations with Governor Brown regarding the prison issue. And the judges are buying the arguments from Daryl Steinberg that it makes much more sense to, if we're going to spend more money on prisons, spend it to reduce recidivism. And that's the way the judges appear to be leaning. They have directed the lawyers for prisoners and the representatives of the state to meet to discuss a durable solution to the prison crowding problem. And they are requiring lawyers from both sides to discuss early release of low-risk prisoners. And that, to me, is the smartest way. There are over 10,000 life prisoners who are over the age of 60, some over the age of 70, who have the lowest likelihood of reoffending. They're not all Charles Manson and Sirhan Sirhan. Well, We will continue to watch as this one unfolds. And finally today, a big surprise on San Francisco Bay. Billionaire Larry Ellison of Oracle Corporation and his America's Cup racing team have won the America's Cup. And it was quite an amazing comeback. They were down by seven wins in their final contest with New Zealand. And today, in the final race, the American team under the command of Australian Jimmy Spithill beat the Emirates team New Zealand by 44 seconds. Now, I am pleased for the United States. This has been a net plus for San Francisco. As a sailor who loves San Francisco Bay, I'm glad to see so many people exposed to the wonders of sailing and the beauty of our bay. But there's a downside to this, because Larry Ellison is not a very lovable billionaire. And he worked the city over big time. The city took the risks for this event, and there is a shortfall. And maybe the billionaire Ellison, since he won the cup back, will reach into his big wallet and make the city whole. That would be a nice gesture on his part. And the other comments I have are that as a sailor, these 72-foot catamarans that Ellison chose as the boats to race in this year's cup are death machines. And we lost a sailor on the bay in one of the preliminaries a few months ago. These boats go very fast, but they're extremely unstable. There is almost no ballast on these boats, and when they're sailing under a strong wind, only one of the two pontoons is actually in the water. Makes them very hard to steer. And the only real ballast on these boats are the human beings who are members of the crew. And that's why, to some friends, I've characterized this like polo. It is a game for the rich and for the amusement of the rich, and if a pony gets hurt and has to be put down, that's just a cost of the game. And the other piece of it is that the America's Cup was centered in the harbor where we keep our boat. And so for the last 4 months, I haven't been able to park near my boat. There is a T-shirt shop where I normally park. And also, the waterborne gendarmes who are out there, these chase boats, to keep spectators like me on the water from getting in the way of the race, they kept pushing us further and further back from the race so that we couldn't see a damn thing. And we were in no way in danger of interfering with the race or getting in the way of the boats. What I learned after my third outing to watch the America's Cup is that they wanted us to be behind the Oracle party boats. We could not have a better vantage point than Ellison and his buddies. And so Ellison wins. He gets to pick the next venue, the next boats. And I hope he'll think a little harder and consider some of my views. Put that in your database and crunch it, Larry Ellison. That's my news and comment for today. You are authorized to share this podcast with anyone.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.